everyone, and welcome to the second Cinema Faith podcast for July 2017. I'm your host, Jonathan Butrin, and I'm joined once again by the Night Owl, Tim Nelson.
Woo-hoo.
Yeah, yeah.
What's up, guys?
Just a few short nights ago, Tim and I were out at a super late showing of the subject of our podcast today. We're out till 1 o'clock in the morning.
That's for an old man with three kids.
Mm-hmm.
That's late, man.
And it's all for you, dear listeners. We're losing sleep for you because we love you.
We care.
Yes. And I should point out, Tim is normally not a night owl, right? Aren't you normally like kind of for an early riser sort of thing?
Yeah, I like that better. Yeah. I like go to early to bed, early to rise.
Yeah, I'm the
opposite.
It's
not working in any of those three
things. Yeah, right.
Healthy, wealthy, or wise. None of those are working, but I've heard that that's what it's supposed to correlate with.
I've heard that too. I've heard, in fact, that I was listening to this podcast about Alzheimer's, super depressing, and they were like, hey, you know, if you want, you can actually prevent onset Alzheimer's. Well, this lady was really creepy because she was like, you're look to your left, look to your right. One of you is going to have Alzheimer's or be taking care of someone with Alzheimer's. And wow. I'm like, wow, ready to like pass out.
I wonder if this will make it into the podcast.
And then she says, three things that you can do to avoid it. Diet, exercise, and good sleep. And some of us are 0 for 3.
So don't eat the popcorn, don't go to the late movie.
Exactly.
And then and exercise.
So while we can remember the name of the movie we saw, we should probably get into it. So good. It's good to be here, man. Good to be here with you 2 weeks after our last podcast. Yeah.
It's pretty regular, man.
I love it. We were back doing Baby Driver a couple weeks ago, and now here we are. So this is a little treat for our listeners as penance for not having a podcast last week. And it's not quite as hot as last time. Still a little toasty, but it's not as hot, I would say.
But it's a humid kind of heat.
It's humid, yeah. But we're not. It's not quite as hot. But all right. So last time we had a shout out to a listener. Remember that? JQ Lindsay. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, we don't have a shout out today, but I wanted to bring it up. All to say that right now we could be shouting out you out there listening to us. You could leave us a review on iTunes or the Apple Podcast app. Takes about 60 seconds, and you could be shouted out right here,
It could be a terrible review.
Oh, absolutely.
But there you go.
Yeah, be honest. Yeah, Tim will sing you a song. It'll be like a moment. That could be happening right now. So
we'll mention you. You'll be... It's like your name, in The Jerk, where he finds his name in the phone book. This is like your name in the phone book.
There it is.
There you go.
So we strongly recommend that. Please do it. And thank you again to JQ Lindsay. So, Tim, what are we reviewing today for our listeners? What is the topic at hand?
Oh, geez.
Do you remember?
I remember.
It's the exercise.
It's called Dunkirk.
Dunkirk. Yes, there it is. We have seen Dunkirk, and we are ready to talk about it. So here we go, man. All right. Now, I know, Tim, you normally don't like doing synopsises, right? But
correct.
Would you be willing to make an exception in this case, since this is an historical narrative, and you broke down history to me in the car on the way there that was so profound, and it finally you located this movie in history. Would you just be able to give a little brief snapshot of where we're at in history if someone's not familiar with the story of Dunkirk? And I'll take it from there,
I guess. So here's my understanding of it. May 1940 is where this is set. The Germans have taken over occupied France, and they beat the English back and also the French back to all the way to the coast, across from the channel to the city of Dunkirk. And there are, 400,000 people trapped, soldiers trapped? And they're trapped there, and there's no way basically to get them out. There's not a good way to get them out. And so what has happened is there's a call that goes out to not military boats, but civilian boats, vessels in England, to, hey, get over here and help rescue these troops. And so that call goes out.
So basically, if you're facing the sea, what sea would that be? The English Channel. Right. England's on the other side. That's where they want to get to. That's home, because we're talking about the English forces here. And to their back is, they're surrounded. So, completely on all sides, they're surrounded in their back and then looking towards the British Channel that they cannot get across.
So it's actually viewed historically as this horrible failure.
Mm-hmm.
As far as strategically, not bad that they're trying to rescue their army. That's good. England is. But this happens before the Battle of Britain, which is happening right after this. where basically there's an all-out assault from Germany on England itself, and there's bombings, and all the children are sent to the countryside. So if you read like the backdrop of Narnia, that's the backdrop. Oh, that's why they're getting sent to the countryside, because they want to get them away from places of strategic importance. So that's the Battle of Britain. That'll happen after this.
And they needed the troops, right, that were on that beach. Like, yeah. It couldn't just be like, oh, we'll just leave
them. So they need an army, because they're going to have to fight Germany later.
Yep.
So anyway, it's this pivotal moment, and it's viewed, I think, with great pride, almost like the Alamo would be for Texans, you know, where the Alamo is like this pretty massive loss, but there was like a stand taken here. Mm-hmm. And I think Dunkirk has looked at this thing of like, hey, look, we didn't have a lot of resources and we got out of there somehow. And then the Battle of Britain is more, actually probably more like that stand.
Perfect. Thank you. So that places us in history. World War II. Did you mention that?
No, that's what you said. About that. I think. I was just assuming World War II. It, but yeah, that's
yeah,
right.
Well, no, don't assume, because I didn't
States
know.
The United States is not in it yet. In yes. fact, that's why this film was like a little bit of a gamble, because apparently people in the U.S. love their war films.
Uh-huh.
But we like to be in them. And so there's nobody, you know, American in this yet, because we didn't get in the war yet. So it's very British film. And he was, I guess, making the wager that we'd actually care here in the United States about this British film.
There you go. And the story is constructed in three different parts. So you start off, the first story is actually on the beach of Dunkirk. We follow this one guy as he kind of makes his way to the beach, and he's trapped, and he's trying desperately to get onto any boat he can to get off Dunkirk Beach and back to home. The second story is actually one of the civilian boats that's been called out is making its way to Dunkirk. And the third story is a pilot in the air. What is that plane that he was driving called?
Oh, geez. I remember the name of the yeah. I always forget the British planes, but it's the RAF, so like Royal Air Force.
Royal Air Force, okay.
And they've got their fighter planes, and I forget the name of their fighter planes. I remember
I know,
they have
they
Merlin.
Said it like
they got Rolls
times.
Royce Merlin engines. That's all I remember.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. So anyway, this Royal Air Force pilot is kind of circling the beach of Dunkirk, and he is getting involved in some firefights up top and also protecting the people on land. So you have those three stories that intersect in really cool ways, and it kind of ping-pongs back and forth between them, and that is the genius behind the film. So to get to that, we need to first talk about the real genius behind the film, which is, of course, Christopher Nolan. All right, Tim, so when did Christopher Nolan first show up on your radar? Do you remember back when, like, you remember seeing
Memento.
His name? Memento.
Yeah, yeah, so Memento was the film. And what is that? I don't even know.
It was 2000.
Okay.
2000, yeah.
So I remember Memento coming out, and it kind of started slow. So like, but then I remember the word out on the street about it. I mean, we talk mm-hmm. about the word on the street sometimes.
Well, it was an indie film. It wasn't like a
yeah,
big thing.
I just remember people started saying, oh my gosh, you got to see this film. It is a total trip. It'll like mess with your head. And it is like no other film we've seen. And so Memento was the first one, because it was a non-linear narrative. Actually, it is linear. It's just backwards, right?
Exactly.
And so it was really interesting thing. It was psychological,
mm-hmm.
and mm-hmm. it was incredibly well executed, well written. And I don't think it had a huge budget either. I could be wrong.
Absolutely not.
And it was really dealing with the idea of identity and consciousness and a whole bunch of like these massive themes that, but doing it in a way that was entertaining.
True story. I did my senior thesis on Memento. It was like the senior project you have to do to graduate. So I graduated with a film degree, and that was my big thing. I basically made a little documentary about Memento where I tore it apart from every angle, from cinematography, you know, sound, everything. And it's a beautiful, brilliant classic movie. I mean, it really is. And yeah, it's completely backwards. We're basically like because the main character has short-term memory loss. So every single scene begins in a place that's totally unfamiliar to us, just like it's totally unfamiliar to him. And then it ends in a place that is familiar, because it ends in the place where the last scene ended. And it's tough, difficult to explain.
So
but,
we're discovering... Yeah. I like what you said. Like, you're discovering this person as they're discovering themselves.
Exactly.
And so you're kind of almost like you're joined to that character emotionally,
mm-hmm.
which is pretty cool device.
It is. And this is kind of gets to the heart of Nolan, because nothing he does is gimmicky. It's not just style for the sake of style. Like, he's always in service of the story, right? So we see this in Memento, where it's not just that it was cool to go backwards in time. He does it because we can be disoriented like the character, and this shows up in all of his work. And when you walk through the filmography of this dude, it's insane. Like, directors would drool to have the track record of Nolan, right? It all began with what was the
Following,
yes, yeah. Which I saw ages ago, I think, but that was like on a shoestring budget, right?
And so I thought at first, I was like, he did, I keep telling people 50,000, but it was film stock. Like, that, it was like $3,000.
Oh, wow.
And so they would rehearse and rehearse and rehearse because they couldn't afford to do more than two takes.
Gosh.
Based on the film, because it was actually, the film stock was some, you know, and he got friends and, you know, buddies to do it. And it was, and it's a really good movie. You can watch that on Netflix.
It's on Netflix. Great.
And it's super entertaining and well done, but it's just strange that he did it for like next to nothing. Cause you'd think, well, if you didn't have any money, you might make like a 11-minute film.
Mm-hmm.
It's like 90 minutes long.
Dang. And that was his debut.
Yeah.
Just piecing it all together, and there it is. And it's a good movie, and you can watch it on Netflix. And then came Memento, and then he made Insomnia. Do you remember Insomnia? This was Al Pacino and Robin Williams, who's kind of like a crazy serial killer.
I did not see it.
Oh.
It's
really good.
Yeah.
And again, we have the style choices, because what happens is, like, it's one of those towns where it's light out or daylight, like, for months, you know, up in Alaska or something. And so Al Pacino can't sleep. And we get disoriented along with him. And it's just the way that it's shot, the way that we kind of, like, we sort of, like, lose consciousness, just like he is throughout the day. He becomes this, like, walking zombie. It's a great film. And Robin Williams is a super creeper in it. I love it. So then he did a super left turn and did Batman Begins. So, kind of weird, right? Because if you think of that trajectory and then going to Batman, but he really wanted to do this, like, super gritty, real Batman movie. Like, nothing fantastical or comic-y, just straight up, like, Batman as it would really be.
So, what I was surprised about with that is usually, like, somebody would try to find, a studio would try to find a director to do their superhero movie. But this was him pitching this.
Like, yeah, absolutely.
He's like, we got to the term reboot apparently comes from, I mean, it existed before, but it became popularized with this Batman series.
Yep.
So I go, yeah, it's the reboot of Batman.
Yeah.
I'm like, whoa.
It was like a passion project of his. It's pretty amazing. And it was great. I mean, Christian Bale was a great Batman. I honestly, Batman Begins is pretty underrated. I when you go through the trilogy again, you're reminded how good Batman Begins actually is. It's a very solid start to that franchise. I think the reason why it gets overshadowed is because the sequel, The Dark Knight, was epic, right? That's where you have Heath Ledger as the Joker, and it's just like, that is, I mean, is probably will go down as one of the best comic book films ever made. Or, yeah.
So he does something that I think he takes some of the critics point out that he takes Batman and turns it into film noir.
Absolutely.
And it already kind of, like, you have those things going on with Batman, because he's like, you have the city. Mm-hmm. He's like, he's almost a detective in the sense of, like, he's not, like, in the film noir, you have a detective that's not a cop, but he's also not a criminal.
Mm.
So that's Batman.
Yeah.
Okay.
Totally.
And he has to get to the bottom of what's really going on a lot of times in film noir. And so he really runs with it, you know, and then you're in the shadows. I mean, that's Batman.
Absolutely.
So I think Batman coming out of that, and then he fully embraces that kind of historical Batman. You know, it gets away from Adam West, you know, rest in peace.
As far as you can go, yeah. And Heath Ledger was so good as the Joker, won an Oscar for it posthumously.
Right.
Oh, man. But there was a film in between Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, which was, of course, The Prestige.
That's like the best movie.
Honestly,
like, of the movies I've seen of his, I really like this movie, but The Prestige to me was the best of his films.
It's so good. It's just this little gem that you kind of forget about in his catalog because it's not as flashy as his other ones. But when you go back and rewatch that, I mean, that movie just keeps on giving. Even when you know, because the movie's kind of set up like a magic trick. Again, Christopher Nolan, that's what he does. The whole movie is in service of the story.
He tells you in the first scene.
Yeah.
He's like, here's what I'm going to do.
But even when you know the trick, that movie is still works, and I'll be watching it forever. It's a great film. Christian Bale is awesome in that as well, and Hugh Jackman. So that's great. And then we had The Dark Knight Rises. Now, that was the third one to the Batman trilogy, and I would say it's probably the worst of the three, but and it probably is objectively his worst movie, but I mean, you know, we'll cut him some slack on
that. Not bad if that's your worst movie.
Exactly. It still was good, and it ended the franchise okay, but it probably, again, was because it was overshadowed by The Dark Knight and Heath Ledger and all that, and they had to kind of modify the story, because I think the Joker was supposed to be in the third one, and, you know. So we'll forgive that one.
Yeah.
And then came Interstellar. This was 2015. What did you think of Interstellar? I don't know if we've ever talked about that, because I liked it a lot, but a lot of people didn't. It was kind of a love-hate thing. Yeah,
I liked it.
You did? Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't like...
It was on my top 10 of that year. I really liked it. Yeah.
Yeah. I liked it. I mean, I don't have any... I watched it one time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard for me to... I watched it right when it came out.
It was a super epic movie, like 3 hours. You're talking like big conversations about wormholes and time travel, and just it was crazy. But it was also really emotional. Matthew McConaughey was in that, and I thought that was a great movie. And that's it, man. That's the filmography up until Dunkirk. I think that is a classic track record right there. I would take that. So there you go, man. I think, like, he's earned the right to basically see anything he does with that. I think that it's like a pass for life. Like, go see a Nolan movie when it comes out. I think he's earned it. You don't think so?
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think there were, yeah, it's worth seeing. He's building catalog right now. Mm-hmm. It's a little weird because he's not sticking with something that would be genre, but he does stick with themes.
Mm-hmm. He says time shows up in every one of his films.
Right,
I thought that was interesting.
He's screwing with time.
Yeah.
So that's true. And then I think he's into time in a lot of ways, like not just his linear, nonlinear, or chronological or achronological. I think he's into the idea of urgency. So the idea of like, is the character going to get blown up? Is the character gonna do and so the idea of like pushing our sense of urgency with the films. So I think that's like, I mean, obviously that's tension, right? A lot of directors do that, but I think he's kind of obsessed with that
and he's a master at it.
Yeah.
Well, you know what, we forgot Inception. I don't know where that film fits into there, but man, that was with Leonardo DiCaprio. Yeah. And they were doing like Matrix style stunts, and that gets back to another thing that is really great about him, is that he is adamant about not doing special effects just to do them. Like there's the minimum amount of CGI. He'll only do it if he's already shot it and he just needs to enhance it just a little bit. He's like, this is not a George Lucas, you know, let's just, you know, make the whole scene on my computer. It's like, he's very...
You'll never see Jar Jar Binks in these films.
He's adamant about practical effects.
So I want to give you a promise.
And of course, he should be, because George, your movies look dated now, and Christopher Nolan's never will.
They look
and
great.
And that's why, yeah, that's the endure. Problem.
So yeah. One of the things, like, the thematically, is he's into that our consciousness is like makes up who we are. So this is actually an anti-Christian idea. So that our memories and our thoughts and our everything that, like, basically all this input in the world, like what we have access to, that's our identity. And so that could actually morph and change. And so you see that throughout like all of his films, like Memento, right?
Mm, yeah.
Absolutely. So you see that there. And then you also even see it in some of our, where you have multiple identity based on perception, people's perception of who you are, not actually what occurred. So it's kind of challenges like what the things that there isn't an objective reality in some ways. It's our perceptions make the reality. So it's kind of really interesting.
That shows up in absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Tim, what does Nolan bring as a director that makes Dunkirk the movie it is? What would you say shows up from a director's point of view in this one?
So visual storyteller. You don't need to have show me, basically don't tell me.
Yes.
And he's a master of that. I think the thing that strikes me like right off the bat for this thing is that I've seen a whole lot of dogfight movies. I've seen a whole lot of, in fact, we had like Kenny Loggins' Top Gun music in the background. We were like driving home from this movie. I don't know why.
It showed up on the radio.
Yeah. And I was like, man, Top Gun sucks compared to this. And it's like, as far as dogfighting.
Yeah.
So like the dogfighting, like I and the sound mix and everything was so perfect that I was. You feel like you are in the plane.
Yes.
More than you would even like a video game simulator or anything like that. Like you feel like you were in the plane with these folks. And it might have also been our format. We saw it in 70 millimeter. So you feel kind of surrounded by it. And that was just like really, and I've seen all the, I've actually seen dogfight footage before. And mm-hmm. this looks like dogfight footage, except like with in HD with like surrounding me.
I heard he said in an interview that if you see this in the right format, it's like virtual reality without the glasses, and that's what he wanted to go for. And it does feel
It worked.
It's an experience. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what else is the director?
So as far as the music is like tense.
Yeah.
So it's like tense classical. I guess Zimmer did the music.
In like every scene, it's mm-hmm. like gets you focused in on tension. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that's characteristic of this film. What was really weird compared to every other film I've watched, there's a little bit in Interstellar where you feel like there's a light airiness to it. Is that this is this war film that has these beautiful light airiness in some of the shots, and it doesn't match like what I know about Nolan. I'm used to like these dark in the shadows shots, uh-huh. and there's like none of that. Everything's like on a bright sunny beach or the ocean, and I know that's like setting, but that caught me off guard, and it was There's mm-hmm. There's a lot of like the sense of like drowning is constantly there, and then one thing is like. That he plays with our sense of security. So it's like almost like anytime somebody feels like they're secure in the movie, they actually might be in the most danger of all.
Yes.
So the moment that we feel like things are going to work out, that's when we should really be terrified. So it's perfect. It's suspense. Mm-hmm. I like when these guys are they're drinking their tea and eating their bread in the ship hole after they make it out to the
terrifying
to the rescue ships.
Yes.
And then the rescue ship gets torpedoed one of our main characters is paranoid enough to hang out on the deck because he's afraid. And he ends up surviving. Spoiler.
That,
there it is.
No, that scene is crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. And there's tons of stuff like that where mm-hmm. it's like finally it's going to be okay and then it's not. It's classic suspense. Yep. Yeah. I love the way he tells the story too where you have – it's sort of like a little memento almost. Not to the extreme but where you have these three stories and they're going back and forth but then – suddenly they start connecting with each other in really cool ways. And it is sort of like a little puzzle, but it really, at the end of the day, again, it's in service to the story because the feeling that you're left with at the end of it is like that you've gone all 360 on this event, right? You're like been in the sea, in the air, land, everywhere. You've done it all. And that's the effect. And that's why he chose the story that he did or the way to tell it. So Nolan himself has kind of said something interesting. Check this out. This is a quote I found. He said, "I didn't want to try because they were kind of asking why you waited so long because he's had this idea in his head to make a movie about Dunkirk for a while." And he said, "I didn't want to try and take on the subject until I had enough trust from a studio that they would let me make it as a British film but with an American budget." That's the the opportunity I've earned and the one I've taken.
So it's not like some awful BBC special Dunkirk by Christopher Nolan.
And I thought that was awesome because when we were coming back from the movie, before we, I found that quote, you had said that this feels like a British film. In what way did you mean when you said that?
Well, it's got like kind of like this it's got this resolve to it that's like quiet, dignified resolve that seeks to minimize, like to basically endure suffering and minimize like other's impressions of it, which is like super British. So it's kind of like it's like stoicism, but there's a pride that goes with it. So it's different than stoicism. So it's like this pride in like, we can take it and we can endure and we can deal with this. And, because that's who we are as a people. And it's just part of us.
Yeah.
Of course we're going to take our vessel out and rescue and go to war, cause it's the right thing to do. That's honor and something bad might happen. Well, we're going to do it and we're going to go and do it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something British about that.
And it's reserved in a British kind of way, right? No, the whole approach to it.
Yeah, nobody's like rallying anybody. They just do it.
Yeah.
And that's like so different than like a Saving Private Ryan. And it's really like, I guess this idea of like all these people, a whole bunch of people chose to do, quote, the right thing in this movie. And because they all made that choice, there was an outcome that wouldn't have been if they hadn't all individually made those choices. Mm. So it's a very corporate sense. And I think you get that like in the Battle of Britain, like everybody's food rationing. I heard recently, like they didn't stop food rationing until the 50s in England.
Holy smokes.
Because they had been so decimated by the war.
Yeah.
And so everyone was part of this effort. And I think that in American films, you usually have some one sacrificial hero type. And then we revel in that.
I was thinking about what would be the exact opposite of this from an American perspective. And though the main thing that came to mind was Pearl Harbor. Josh Hartnett,
yeah.
Ben Affleck, right. Love Triangle, 3.5 hours long.
Just like miserable Jerry Bruckheimer experiment.
Like Michael Bay excess all along. This is totally the opposite of that because there is really no main character. You don't have some big movie star. You know, you have Cillian Murphy and Mark Rylance who are good actors, but they don't like take over the movie. It's a very, you're right, corporate. I like that word. It's a very British way of making art. And I mean, you see this if you've ever watched a British show versus American shows. I mean, it's like British shows, you know, basically have one, they're basically one season is fine with them. If they go one season, they did it. If they go two, all right, like that, they're starting to get a little excessive for them, and then they'll wrap it up with a bow and some kind of special and call it a day. We're on like season 10, half of everybody has checked out by now. It's like, it's crazy.
I got you.
Yeah. So I love it. He made a British movie with an American budget, and he says he's earned it. That's the opportunity he's earned, and he's right. And you know what I love about that is that it's kind of like he has somehow attracted both the artsy film purists and like mainstream Joe Schmo. Like somehow he has been able to, over the course of his career, combine the indie crowd with the mainstream crowd. It's amazing.
So even more than that, what I've heard is that he's able to get the teenage demographic to like totally love these films, but he's also getting the guys that are the 40 plus year old men to love this film too.
Yeah.
And so that's interesting. And you could go, like, I could see, like, actually, like I said, I couldn't go on a date to Baby Driver.
Yeah.
But I could, strangely enough,
isn't that
I feel
weird?
Like Dunkirk I could, but I would never guess that beforehand.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
He somehow has a style and a touch that really is appealing to anyone and brings everyone in, which is why his movies have sustained box office spread. So, like, Dunkirk's made, like, $60 million or something on opening weekend, but on average, his films just stay, like, consistent, and they're expecting this to ultimately make like 180 just domestically because word of mouth, critics, and then people just going and telling their friends, like, you should go, like going back and taking your wife even though you wouldn't have the first time. That's kind of what's happening.
I don't know if she would go because I'd be like, it's about a battle of Dunkirk, and she'd be like, interesting, right? but yeah, I think it's good. It's also not, there's no, what I like about it is that it doesn't glorify, it's not glorifying war. In fact, it's kind of horrific and miserable, but it's also not anti-war. Like, it's not so overtly anti-war that it's like the messaging overshadows the story. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, you wouldn't be turned off if you were, you don't get any impression of that, but but it's realistic as well. Yeah.
Right. Versus like Tom Hanks submachining gunning a bunch of guys, faceless Nazis. Like, this is not that at all.
Mm-hmm.
It's a rescue story.
It is.
And so, I mean, like Saving Private Ryan's a rescue story, but really it's a story about Tom Hanks submachining a bunch of guys.
Yeah.
If you like Saving Private Ryan,
it's Spielberg,
we'll see how it endures. We'll just be thankful. Like, it's not, all these films are not Pearl Harbor. You're right.
Yes. Yes.
That's like one of the worst movies.
It's just terrible.
A terrible movie.
I saw it in the theater. I remember. All right. Let's talk about the formats of the movie. Cause the release of this was a little bit kooky. So, I should note, first of all, that Nolan is a huge purist when it comes to film. You mentioned film stock in Following. He is adamant about this. He doesn't love the switch to digital. He shoots in film, and he wants to preserve movies in film, which is why he shot in 70mm. Now, he actually shot in 65mm, and they change it to 70.
I don't know how it works.
Whatever. Let's just say he shot it in 70mm, because that's what he was going for. And so he really wants you to see this movie in film in 70mm. And we had the opportunity to see it in 70 because of Quentin Tarantino and his roadshow experience that he blew through our town. We're the only theater in our state near us, thankfully, that had 70mm because of The Hateful Eight.
Yeah. And if we can get a sponsorship from this theater, we could name them and say, they've got a 70mm format that clicks when you're in there. It goes...
You can hear it vibrate. Yeah, it's so great.
Oh,
and
it is.
That's what Nolan wants, is that pure film format. But he also shot in IMAX cameras, and he's a huge believer in that too. So IMAX gives you 40% more screen than even the 70mm print that we saw. Yeah. So the ideal format of this movie is 70mm IMAX. That's what you want, okay? But the problem is only like a handful of theaters around the country are playing it in 70mm IMAX. No one near us, not even in Chicago. Like the
That's
nearest,
miserable. That's it. We're starting a 70mm IMAX theater.
Totally. The nearest one to us is like 5.5 hours away in Minnesota. It's terrible. I am traveling to New York in a couple weeks with my family, a little vacay. I'm hoping that it's still up because currently it is playing a 70mm IMAX in New York.
So you would rewatch it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, can you imagine 40% more screen in 70? And that's like the ultimate experience. And this is a movie that is an experience.
Yeah. I was happy with this, just a 70.
Totally. I would love it.
If you want to reach, you know, a little higher than me, that's all right.
So that's the difference between 70 and IMAX. It's not, 70 is basically the film stock. You're on film. You're not digital. IMAX is the bigger screen size. And you want to combine the two because the problem is most IMAX showings are in digital. And so you kind of have to make that choice. You're going to get the much richer quality film in 70mm as compared to the digital IMAX. And some IMAXs aren't even like true IMAX. Like the IMAX that I grew up with when it first came out was like skyscraper IMAX. But the IMAX near us is not as big. Like there's varying sizes of IMAX. So it's kind of confusing. Okay?
So it's like iMiddle.
iMiddle. Yes.
Wow.
But anyway, there you go. Man. 70mm IMAX is what you want. Love the
but
projector behind
it.
You can't have what
you want. You can't have it unless you live in like Minnesota and you don't even know the difference.
Exactly.
So it's just not fair. So
but it's all right.
Don't even try. Don't even try.
apparently,
don't even try.
I just like was on Twitter and some guy was like, travel any distance you have to go see it in 70 IMAX.
And you're
so
going to do it.
If you can do it. Yeah, I'll do it. I will do that in a New York minute.
Oh, that's pretty good.
There it is.
Yeah, that's good.
Anyway, but 70 was great. It was a great experience. And Hateful Eight was a great experience simply for the 70 too. I wish an intermission was in every movie. That was so awesome.
In a war movie?
No, like, I know. It wouldn't have worked. I'm just saying. It was so fun going out there for a second in the intermission.
Yep.
Anyway. All right. Anything else that really stood out to you in this that really made it special as far as like the artistry of it?
I thought the photography was beautiful.
It was. Now, he used to go with his cinematographer, Wally Pfister, back when he was doing Memento and all that. But Wally Pfister has gone on to actually become a director in his own right. So I should have looked this up if I was being a professional, but I don't know what cinematographer he uses. But whoever it is, still amazing.
Yeah.
Wonderfully shot film. Yeah.
Yeah. It's also like so different, like when you're doing a natural outdoor, because we've seen a lot of that, like with Revenant, we've talked about that, like where it's like all this natural light. It's a very different thing than somebody who is using like half lit images of faces in the noir style. This is a very different thing to tackle because this is like high levels of light in every scene.
Yes. And you mentioned how beautiful the 70 looks in water scenes, which I think is so true. It just pops out. Yeah.
Yep.
All right, man, let's go deep. Thematic elements, you see at play here. You take the first bat at this.
So one thing I read said he's very materialistic. So it's like what he's not into necessarily a deeper meaning of anything. He's into what is actually happening right now. Will they escape? So he's very much in the present and not trying to necessarily make us think about a bigger thing. So not necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
He's very materialist. So he's not trying to point us to some greater reality outside of reality. He's pointing us to this happened, this reality.
Sure. And it feels very present every moment. You're right.
Right. Yeah. So I think that there's something to the, like, it feels very present even though it's not linear. So I think the idea of the, one of the things that I noticed was he's playing with the idea of heroism in this. Because you do have a classic hero in the pilot.
Yeah.
But you also have people who are allowed to be heroes who didn't do anything heroic, which I thought was really interesting. And then people who are honored as heroes who've done nothing but survive.
Hmm.
It's like, you know, you guys are heroes. We didn't do anything but survive. And because they didn't win a battle and they didn't, and they just, they ended up, they were like basically looking out for number one and they survived and then they come back honored heroes. So it's kind of like how some of those themes of like, what is heroism? Who creates it? Is it the actual deeds or is it the people who need to have those impressions of people?
Right, because there's a character who does something awful, but he's suffering from like PTSD, and they honor him. And mm-hmm. then there's a character, like you said, who basically doesn't really do anything heroic, but they honor him as well, which is kind of mm-hmm. a very British thing. And yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, so it's playing with our notion of what heroism is. Mm-hmm. And then people who did incredible stuff aren't necessarily even highlighted at all. So in this case, we have some of the people in the fleet of those boats.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's playing with our notions of what creates heroism, what creates, like what makes somebody exceptional in a wartime situation. And so it's not necessarily that they did something great. It's that we need to have that impression of certain people in order to make meaning out of the actual things that occurred, which is kind of interesting. Is that we are creating meaning out of the facts. This gets like very Freudian, right?
I like that.
But if we can't handle that meaning, we've got to change the meaning. So, and we make the facts fit with our meaning because we can't deal with that reality, which is kind of interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
So I had two big takeaways. The first one concerns the civilian boats that show up at the end to kind of save the day. Not a spoiler. It's history. All right, folks, come on. So one of the big moments is when you have this big fleet of civilian boats coming because they are going to rescue these guys at the beach of Dunkirk. And this is basically when all hope is lost. You have this horrible situation where these people on this beach are like, there's a plane that comes every now and then and drops a bomb, and they all just hit the deck because that missile could be falling right on them. I mean, right. That's it. That could be it. Everyone basically like closes their eyes and we're like, here we go. This might be it. And so they're stuck. They have nowhere to go. And these civilian boats come in. It's a really beautiful moment. It's kind of the first moment where the music actually isn't tense and in your face and actually turns kind of sentimental, yeah. Right? So I love that. And it just made me think, there's a point where, okay, so in one of the story strands, you're following the one civilian boat as it's making its way to Dunkirk. And they pick up Cillian Murphy, who is like stuck because his boat was torpedoed by a U-boat and he's like stuck in the middle of the sea, and they pick him up. And he's like, when he finds out they're going back to Dunkirk, he flips out because he was there. It's a hellhole. He doesn't want to go back. And he looks at Mark Rylance, who's like the captain of this boat, and he's like, what are you doing? Like, you're a civilian pleasure boat, and you're literally going to war. Like, that's madness. Like, yeah. Stop.
It's like, you don't appreciate what you're doing.
Yeah.
Which is probably true.
Exactly. And I remember thinking as the audience, he's got a good point. Like, mm-hmm. What are you doing? Like, you're literally taking these two, like, what, 17-year-old kids off to the middle of this battle in your pleasure boat. That's insane. I mean, cool. But naive, right?
Yeah.
And they don't even have any guns to protect them. How are they going to help people? But then you have this beautiful moment where you realize it's not just one boat. It's 10 boats. It's 20 boats. Maybe like 100 boats. I don't know how many there were, but all of them come collectively, and that is what saves the day. So no, Cillian Murphy's right. One boat couldn't have done it, but together they basically save the whole thing. And so I thought it was a really cool analogy for like the body of Christ, man. Like one of us just by ourselves, what can we do, right? But what maybe a hand or a foot or a nose, but together using our gifts, we can actually make a difference in the world. I thought that was cool. We have to work together, right? That's what actually makes a difference. I was listening to this guy, pastor recently, and he was saying, what if we all, every Christian came to in our state came together in a stadium, like collectively, and decided to do one thing together. Like we could change our whole city around. But why don't we? Why would we never get in the stadium together? Why don't we work together? It's something to think about. So the body, I thought that was really cool. And then kind of on a related note, that in order to be the body, we have to be willing to lay down our sword and pick up our cross. So Jesus said these words that just slay me every time I hear it. You've heard it was said, You should love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, so that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. If you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Don't even tax collectors do that? If you greet only your brothers, aren't you doing even what the Gentiles do? It's this idea that we're supposed to love even our enemies, and that's completely incompatible with this idea of picking up a gun and actually trying to kill your enemies. And this is something that the early church really drove home. Like, you have these quotes from like Justin Martyr, who's like an early church father, is basically like, in past times, we who killed one another, don't fight our enemies. And so there's basically this idea of turning the instruments of war into instruments of love now. And so I think you have this connection where, like you said, Nolan doesn't like drive home the point, but you definitely get the reality of war, that it turns men inward. It turns them into this like kind of necessarily selfish men, where it's all about, I've got to survive this, I've got to get past this. And you don't see that in the civilian boats. And they're actually become the true heroes of the movie, because here they are not coming in with weapons, but coming in just to save life. And I think that is kind of a picture of how a Christian should be interacting in the world.
So before we watched the movie, we talked about Hacksaw Ridge.
Yes.
And so, which got just a lot of praise last year. And I think the Hacksaw Ridge ideas there's some similar themes in Hacksaw Ridge, which is like this idea of like this non-combatant that is willing to go to save life. So I think I think this film's a lot better than Hacksaw.
I think it's better. Yes. Yeah. Yes. As far as the theme of that, I think it drives it home even that point a little bit clearer, because he won't bring the sword into battle, but he's willing to be there in the midst of death to be life and hope. And he's even willing in that movie to help an enemy like when he needs help. And I think that's really, really cool. But
I don't relate to him at all.
Right.
So, but I felt more like I could relate to the boats. Mm-hmm. We were just like, all right, here we go. So it was like in a moment of weakness, people go do it.
Yeah.
Not a moment of strength.
Yeah.
So I actually thought it was more relatable in this film than this, and less preachy. Like, it felt really preachy in Hacksaw. We're just kind of like, all right, okay, all right. And in this film, it didn't feel that way. It felt like, no, this just happened. Mm-hmm. This occurred, because it did just happen in this film, right? I know Hacksaw happened too, but like, this was less about making a point and more about, these guys need us.
I love that. That's really cool. Is that it's making this a very similar point, or you can derive a similar point to Hacksaw, but it's not beating you over the head with it. Right. It's just showing it. That's a lesson to all of us Christian filmmakers out there.
Yeah. It's like, so if Hacksaw is in contention last year, and this is not as a good of a year, this film has to be.
Oh, come on. I know, right? Yeah. I mean, this is definitely the best film I've seen this year, for sure. And I can't imagine that this isn't going to be. There would have to be, like, to imagine 10 better movies than this by the end of the year. I don't know. I don't see it. But
could be. Who knows?
I mean, who knows? We don't know what's going to happen. But I would imagine it's going to be in contention for some things. Maybe even, especially Christopher Nolan as director. Come on.
So you know I'm going to say something about old film now, right?
Do it.
Okay, so one of the major influences for this film is a film that I saw way back in the day. I was taking a theology and film class, and it's called The Wages of Fear. Have you heard of The Wages of Fear?
Never.
So this is one, like, put on your list after we watch all the Kurosawa films.
That's right.
So The Wages of Fear is, I think it's French, early 1950s. And it's this, basically it's about this South American oil company who has this horrible oil well fire that's like beyond the mountains at one of their new oil wells. Mm-hmm. And none of the union people are considered like worthy of, like, they got to put it out. So they have this truck full of nitroglycerin, because nitroglycerin will basically take the oxygen away from the fire and put it out, but it's like super dangerous. So they try to recruit people to take this truck over the like one lane horrible mountain roads. And the idea is, like, if you hit a bump, you blow up. So it's like, in the same way, this film is tense the whole time. And then they're unwilling to take union laborers, so they have to like look for like townspeople that maybe have sorted paths or don't qualify to be a. So they're like unlikely people to do it, which you can see direct connections to the Nolan film, which is like, well, this historical event had a bunch of like pleasure yachts that were doing the job that somebody else should have been doing, but there was nobody else.
Yeah.
So he's drawing from that. But that film's like, in film, they use that film as a study of suspense and tension, because it's a film that's able to maintain tension the entire time. And that's one of the films he draws off of. So what I would say, and I always say this in the podcast, which is, this film's a great film. Help it. Go look at what this film came out of, because there's always a lineage to these good films. And I would say go watch Wages of Fear if you haven't seen Wages of Fear. So that's my pitch for the old film.
Perfect. When did that come out?
53, I think. 53. But I could be wrong. It's early 50s.
Okay.
Yep.
Perfect. All right. Final thoughts on Dunkirk, Tim. Here you go. Last chance.
Already?
Yes.
Wow.
I know.
Final thoughts on Dunkirk. Don't wait for it to come out in some tiny format. Even if you have a big TV, it ain't big enough.
Absolutely.
So go see it. If you're in our area, go to the 70 millimeter showing. It's worth the extra, what is it, a couple bucks more or something. It's totally worth it. It'll be fantastic to go to that. Don't miss it while it's in the theaters, because you will regret it. When else are you going to do it? There's no other way to really watch this film. And you can go by yourself. You can go with somebody. It's not like you don't need your high-fiving buddies like you did for Baby Driver. you can definitely watch it. Just go to the movies. And so I'd highly recommend it. Great movie. And we'd love to hear your feedback too. So like, throw us some comments, review the podcast on iTunes. And we'd love to hear what you think.
So what's your letter grade?
I give it an A.
Giving it a straight A.
Yeah, I can give an A+, right?
So, you can.
Right. I'm not going to.
That's a classic. That's like above and beyond.
I give it an A because I think I respected this was a shorter movie. It's 103 minutes. And I think that's what it needed, 103 minutes. Mm-hmm. And the temptation with a film like this is to like just go way long with it. And it was perfect.
Yep.
It was just perfect. And I would give it definitely an A. A+ would go to top three films of the year. So I'd say this is an A. I think it will be nominated in some categories. I don't know which ones.
Awesome. I totally agree. See it in the theater. I was just talking to a friend. He was like, yeah, maybe, you know, I'll probably catch on Redbox. Do not wait for Redbox. This is not a Redbox movie.
Really?
No, don't do it. Because you're missing, like, if you read any interview with Nolan, he is telling you, I created this for the theater, because Nolan he sees where film is going with video on demand, and he wants to create unique experiences that actually demand the extra money. Like, how much money are you paying to go to the theater? He wants to create content that actually makes that journey worth it. See it in the theater. On IMAX, you're getting 40% more screen than you'll get at home. And in 70 millimeter, you can't replicate that, because everything that comes to your laptop is digital. See it on the screen.
See it on the screen.
Yes.
I totally agree.
I liked this better than I thought I was going to. I mean, the reviews were rock solid, so I knew it was going to be good, but I wasn't expecting it to be as tense, as first person as it was. It was a true cinematic experience. Great acting, music, directing, everything comes together. I am giving it an A-. I won't say the movie's perfect. I would say the one thing, it felt like something was slightly missing emotionally, and maybe that's just me used to American films, you know? And I even get this with British TV sometimes, where it feels like slightly like reserved. And, you know, I think it's just a cultural thing, but I'll give it an A-, all right? Definitely the best movie I've seen this year. It's at the top of my top 10. But yeah, so absolute must see.
So who is the guy that said we had to see this in the movie theater again?
Me. That's right.
When I saw the preview, it was like, oh my gosh. I was like texting you back and forth. It's like, we have to see this. And it really lived up.
To
I mean.
Yeah. Better than I thought it would. Absolutely. Yeah. So there you have it, man. Movie's Dunkirk. It is playing in a theater near you. I hope you enjoyed your two podcasts for the price of one this month.
What a deal.
We will be back in August with a review of
what
The Dark
that?
Tower. That's what we're doing next.
I didn't
Dark
even
Tower.
Know that. Do you know, yes. Folks, I just found this out just now. You might have told me at some point, but it's in my yes. conscious.
Stephen King's epic series is being distilled into a movie, and we are seeing that next. And then actually, in September, this is going far out, we'll probably be tackling It, because we think we were both excited about that. So that's a back-to-back Stephen King
podcast. I'm afraid of it. I'm going to be honest. Like, I'm afraid to watch that movie because, you know, clowns, killer clowns in sewers. Not like really...
And you remember the creepy TV adaptation, right? And
yes, I do. The clown. Oh gosh.
I hope it's good. And Stephen King himself said that it totally is lived up to his expectations. I hope he's not just saying that. But the preview was pretty dang creepy.
I don't know. It freaks me out. Although I like Stephen King.
Yeah. And then, of course, in October is Blade Runner 2049. So
getting pretty pumped about that.
I'm so pumped about it. We got a string of great movies coming up. So there you go. So tell your friends about this podcast if you haven't already. Leave us a review. And, of course, leave us any comments at our email address, which is podcast@cinemafaith.com. We welcome any and all feedback, and we will read it on the air. So there you go.
Well, not everything.
You're right. Maybe not everything.
Within a reasonable limit.
Yes. All right, Tim. Always a pleasure talking film, man. Keep the faith, my friends. We will see you next time.